From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The UWA are showing an incredible amount of bravery and integrity defending by speaking out publicly against this. I mean, by speaking out, they have essentially a target on their heads. And when Occidental calls them guerrillas, that is a death sentence.
The late Terence Freitas, murdered in Colombia with two other U.S. activists 3 years ago, the Bush administration is using their case to justify further military aid to Colombia. Then, more on the Venezuelan coup. What did the U.S. Navy have to do with it? 10 years after the Los Angeles uprising, a roundtable discussion, and bankruptcy and abortion?
Across the country, violent anti-choice protesters are hiding behind bankruptcy laws to avoid paying court-ordered fines.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Resistance Radio. Millions of people all over the world took to the streets on International Workers' Day yesterday to support workers' rights, call for global justice, and protest fascism and racism. Over a million protested in cities across France 2 weeks after the extreme right wing Jean-Marie Le Pen won second place in the first round of the presidential elections. Some 800,000 people packed boulevards and squares in Paris alone in one of the biggest demonstrations the city's seen since the student revolt of May 1968. The London Guardian reports veterans of the 1968 revolt, who turned cynical by the unremitting rise of global capitalism, stood by in disbelief. One said, quote, "I was at the communist demonstrations in 1936. I was at May 68, but I've never seen anything like this. It's entirely peaceful. People are in a state of revolt, but they're smiling. Their message comes from the heart." In Australia, mounted police repeatedly charged into 500 demonstrators blockading the Sydney headquarters of a company that runs the country's controversial immigration detention centers. Over 30 were arrested. Protesters later marched on the offices of the World Bank, the Stock Exchange, the Israeli consulate, and Australian government buildings. 15,000 people in the Philippines defied heavy security to rally in support of deposed President Joseph Estrada and against the current Philippine President Gloria Arroyo. Three people died when a grenade was thrown at people dancing on a basketball court in Cotabato in the south of the country. Half a million people rallied in Italy to protest Silvio Berlusconi's proposed reforms they say will make it easier to sack workers. Police in Berlin and Hamburg made 80 arrests after violent confrontations with activists. Some 75 demonstrations were held across Spain and Calcutta. 2,000 sex workers held a torchlight march to demand legal status and social benefits. A million people marched in Cuba. Thousands of global justice activists marched through London. Police arrested 50. Police in armored vehicles clashed with 1,500 protesters in Turkey and arrested 20, including a Kurdish political leader. Thousands in Syria took to the streets to show support for the Palestinian uprising. Israeli troops lifted a five-month siege of Yasser Arafat's offices last night under a deal brokered by the U.S. and Britain. At the same time, six wanted Palestinians were transferred to a jail where they will be supervised by U.S. and British guards in the occupied territories. U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan plans to disband the mission, which would have investigated atrocities in the Jenin refugee camp. Israel initially endorsed the fact-finding team and said it had nothing to hide, but Israel reversed course and has repeatedly refused to cooperate. Palestinians accuse Israel of massacring civilians. Israeli sources say the Bush administration pressured Israel to lift the siege on Arafat in return for Washington's support in blocking the Jenin inquiry. In a statement yesterday, the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said he regretted that with the mission's cancellation, quote, "the long shadow cast by recent events in the Jenin refugee camp will remain." In Bethlehem, gunfire and explosions broke out last night around the Church of the Nativity, which has been besieged by the Israeli military for the past 4 weeks. Fires broke out in areas of the church. Some 1,000 British troops have swept into the mountains in eastern Afghanistan to hunt down and destroy suspected Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters. Operation Snipe is led by the British Royal Marines and is the largest British combat mission since the Gulf War. The U.S. is providing some troops and air support. There is only a token Afghan presence. U.S. Commander General Tommy Franks asked for the Royal Marines after the lack of success of U.S. forces at Tora Bora and with Operation Anaconda. This follows repeated allegations that Afghan allies have allowed hundreds of Taliban and al-Qaeda, including Osama bin Laden, to escape during their operations. Pakistan's military regime has declared victory in its widely criticized presidential referendum. The chief elections officer said nearly 98% of votes were cast to extend General Musharraf's rule and claimed a turnout of around 60%. But the independent and well-respected Human Rights Commission of Pakistan said irregularities during the vote exceeded our worst fears. The commission alleged officials stuffed boxes with yes votes, that most votes were cast by state employees, factory workers, and prison inmates, and voluntary turnout very low. Few women cast a ballot. Many people voted several times, encouraged by local councillors. This news from Zimbabwe. A U.S. citizen who reports for the London Guardian was arrested in his home in Harare yesterday. Andrew Meldrum was detained for a story about a supporter of Zimbabwe's opposition party who'd reportedly been beheaded in front of her children by followers of President Robert Mugabe. Two journalists from the Independent Daily News were detained on Tuesday for publishing the same story. And universities condemned a plan by the Bush administration to stop foreign students in the U.S. studying, quote, sensitive academic courses. The presidential directive slipped largely unnoticed into a wider set of initiatives announced by the Office of Homeland Security last October. It requires the government to, quote, prohibit certain international students from receiving education and training in sensitive areas, highlighting specifically, quote, areas of study with direct application to the development and use of weapons of mass destruction. Prominent academics say the proposed new rules were discussed in secret, excluding university representatives. They argued any foreigner who received a visa was a matter for the Immigration Service.
We don't care about evidence. We don't care about negotiation. We don't care about treaties. We're the strongest guy around, you know, toughest leg on the block. We do what we want.
50 righteous stars and 14 stubborn stripes, stacked up high like some tourist postcards, cheaper than handy wipes. Big banners and big amounts are flapping in the breeze, kicking up the dust. Talking heads are praying on those frightened people's trust. Pulling on the strings to keep the puppet flags waving.
Puppet Flags featuring Noam Chomsky. You can get more at www.picassos-crayon.com. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
And good day to our listeners all around the country.
And a good piece you had in the New York Daily News today on your continued investigation of the cover-up at Ground Zero, the environmental hazards, particularly you focused on asbestos today.
Yes, and another building half a mile north of Ground Zero turns out to have been contaminated with asbestos all of these last 7 months. And the building was particularly noteworthy. It was a co-op residence, but it also had a child care center in it. And the co-op board said that they believed what EPA and the city told them at the, right after September 11th, that the air was fine. So they never really did any testing of their building until one of the residents did it, and now they've had to do a professional cleanup. But there's probably hundreds of buildings throughout Lower Manhattan that need to be tested and cleaned up by the federal government, and the government is still resisting any pressure or efforts, any pressure by citizens and political leaders to do so.
Well, moving now to an international issue, we go to Colombia. Attorney General John Ashcroft Tuesday announced indictments against Colombia's FARC rebel group and six of the members of FARC who They allege killed three Americans in 1999. Ashcroft says the indictments against FARC demonstrates the Bush administration's determination to prosecute terrorists outside the Muslim world. People close to those who were killed are outraged. They say the Bush administration is using the three-year-old murders as a PR effort in the so-called war on terror to drum up support for increased U.S. military aid to Colombia. Terrence Freitas is one of those who was murdered. He worked with the indigenous UWA people against the U.S.-based oil company Occidental Petroleum, which the UWA have long alleged works hand-in-hand with the human rights-abusing Colombian military and paramilitaries. But U.S. military aid is destined in part to help guard Occidental Petroleum's pipeline in the area. The same day that Ashcroft announced the indictment, Secretary of State General Colin Powell certified the Colombian military as complying with human rights requirements that allowed the State Department to release more than $60 million in military aid. Meanwhile, the White House is currently seeking congressional support to allow U.S. military aid to Colombia to be used directly against the FARC. Military aid is currently restricted, they say, to counter narcotics operations. The three U.S. activists who were killed in 1999, Terrence Freitas, Ingrid Washnawatak, and Lahe Gay. Right now, we're joined by Abby Reyes, who is the girlfriend of Terrence Freitas, former co-director of the UWA Defense Project, currently a law student at UC Berkeley, as well as Terrence's mother, Julie Freitas. And they have issued a statement to the Bush administration about their use of the murders. We welcome you both to Democracy Now. Julie Freitas, Terrence Freitas' mother, let's begin with you. Can you talk about what your response is to the administration's policy over the last few days?
Yes, good morning. Well, I was pretty disappointed when I read in the paper about their position. I know my son would not want anyone to exploit his life and death in order to increase the military aid to the Colombian armed forces. When he was there, he was really aware of the human rights atrocities of all the armed groups operating in Colombia, the guerrillas, the paramilitaries, and the army alike, and employing his death to continue perpetuating violence in Colombia grossly contradicts everything which my son believed in. And it's really hard work when you're working for peace. And it takes a lot more guts than empowering more people with guns.
Well, it was reported on today's newspapers that the State Department has certified Colombia as having made progress in dealing with human rights abuses and in the country and to qualify it for more U.S. government aid. What's your reaction to that latest announcement by our State Department?
You mean about them extraditing these people that murdered the three Americans?
The State Department has certified that Colombia is making progress in eliminating human rights violations within the country.
Well, I'm really not aware of that. I'd love to be more aware of that. What I've read in the paper and what I've heard is there's continuing killing, there's continuing kidnapping, and there's just continuing expansion of oil drilling, and I don't see the violence decreasing at all.
What about the Bush administration's using the murder of your son, as well as Ingrid Washnawatak and Lahe Gay?
I'm absolutely appalled. And the thing that bothers me the most is they say that these people are extradited, and a couple of months ago they reported that they had found the person responsible for the murders, and they prosecuted him and sentenced him to 40 years of jail, but he's nowhere to be found. And these other people that they're extraditing, they're nowhere to be found either. So it just seems like an announcement of that the U.S. is doing something about the so-called terrorism, but none of these people are to be found. Also, Occidental Oil is having their shareholders meeting on Friday, and I just wonder how much all this announcing is related to their desire to have money to protect the oil pipelines that are being blown up.
Let's go for a minute to this audio tape, which is from 1997. I had a chance to interview Terrence Freitas, your son, Terry, when he was alive on October 6, 1997, with Steve Kretzmann of Project Underground on Democracy Now! So what is going to happen now? You have this group of people, you have this Indian tribe, the Uwa, there are about 4,000 of them, who say that they're going to commit mass suicide if Occidental Petroleum moves ahead. What is the organizing happening there and also here in this country?
The organizing here, there's a number of environmental and human rights groups that are just now coming together and to organize a strong campaign in defense of the Uwa Pueblo. And so that's not something, it's not a campaign against Occidental or against oil companies or against U.S. business interests. It's in defense of the Uwa Pueblo. It's in defense of international indigenous rights. And it's in defense of corporate responsibility. So what we're doing, we have groups like Project Underground, Rainforest Action Network, Earth Justice, Legal Defense Fund, and we're working with these kinds of groups to bring together a strong coalition that will make sure that Occidental understands that it has a responsibility in the indigenous territories, and also to put pressure on the Colombian government.
I think one thing that's important to underscore is here that, you know, all the Uwa that we talk to, they're very clear about no one wants to die. This is not a publicity stunt. Actually, one thing that's worth noting is that when the Spanish first arrived in Colombia, a portion of the Uwa at that time, unable to fathom living under Spanish colonial rule, committed mass suicide. And that time was in the 1600s, wasn't it, Terry?
Yeah, what ended up happening is the tribe was essentially trapped. They kept moving further and further into the mountains, and then they were at a point where the leader of the tribe said, "We can't live as slaves. We can't live like a lot of the Uwa who are being enslaved. And if we can't." And the Uwa don't believe in fighting either. That's the thing, is they don't believe in violence at all. That's part of the structure of their society. And so the only lives that they can really threaten are their own.
Right. And so, I mean, they're very clear about not wanting to die. However, they're also very serious about if they are left with no options, that is the option that they won't move forward with. They're obviously doing a lot of organizing and a lot of work in Colombia.
Yeah, they're doing a tremendous amount of work in Colombia. And, I mean, understand that the political situation in Colombia is very similar to the political situation in Nigeria, where resistance to development projects like this one ends up usually in the death of a number of the resistors. I mean, there's... If you look at the elections in Colombia that just occurred, before the elections there were 123 electoral candidates shot, okay, and over 300 kidnapped. Okay, that gives you kind of an idea of what's happening there. And with that, the Uwa are showing an incredible amount of bravery and integrity defending by speaking out publicly against this. I mean, by speaking out, they have essentially a target on their heads. And when Occidental calls them guerrillas, that is a death sentence.
And that was the late Terrence Freitas, who was murdered in Colombia along with Lahe Gay and Ingrid Washin-Watok in March of 1999, a tape from 1997. Juan?
Yeah, I'd like to ask Abby Reyes, as we're listening to that tape and you've heard the news of these attempts now by the federal government to extradite the people involved, what's your feelings and reaction to the role of the government vis-a-vis the very issues that Terry was fighting over and its attempt now to utilize these murders now for its own ends?
Good morning. Terrence went to Colombia to work with local communities that were, even at that point, grappling with the escalation of legal and extra-legal armed violence that Occidental's presence in the region has wreaked over the last 15 years. To the 24 social organizations in that region today who are still protesting this pipeline and are particularly protesting the U.S. military intervention on behalf of the defense of the pipeline, oil equals violence, and you can't separate the two. My reaction is just it feels like a cynical, manipulative, and exploitative use of the murder, and it kind of boils my blood, to be honest. I wanted to tell you as a counterpoint to Colin Powell's statement, which was announced in Congress at the same time as Attorney General Ashcroft was doing the press conference announcing the indictments, that just 2 months ago, on February 5th, three very well-respected human rights organizations, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and the Washington Office on Latin America, released a document with extensive evidence, again proving that Colombia's security forces meet none of the human rights conditions required by the public laws that President Bush himself signed in January. So it just depends on who you want and whose evidence you want to believe on that one.
What about the recent piece in the Los Angeles Times, Abby, by Christian Miller, another documentation of a massacre, this in Santo Domingo in Colombia, that was conducted by paramilitaries and the military in the connection to the United States military funding?
That article, I'm glad you brought it up, because the Santo Domingo case is a very apt example of the way in which Occidental Petroleum is in bed with every armed actor in Colombia. In a quick summary of the situation, which I know mostly also from the article to which you're referring, is that in late 1998, a few months before Terrence, Ingrid, and Lahey were murdered, and during their Christmas celebrations, a village called Santo Domingo near the Occidental Pipeline in northeastern Colombia was bombed. 11 adults, 7 children died. According to the Colombian military court records, the U.S. government helped initiate those military operations on that day that the bombing happened, and that two private American companies helped plan and support them. One of those... And there's no evidence that the U.S. government or American companies knew that their aid might lead to the destruction of the village, but there is evidence that lets us know that the events leading up to the battle outside of the village that ended in the explosion were initiated by a U.S. government surveillance plane that had detected an aircraft allegedly carrying weapons for the guerrillas. They conveyed that information to the 18th Brigade, which we'll talk about in a minute, of the Colombian Armed Forces. And they linked it to the potential running of drugs, and that's how it was justified that the U.S. government surveillance plane get involved in the first place. The Los Angeles-based Occidental Petroleum also provided crucial assistance to the operation. It routinely, and in this case, well, they don't, Occidental hasn't yet admitted that it, in this case, helped. The report and witnesses on the ground say so, that it supplied directly or through contractors, troop transportation planning facilities.
Abby, who are the men who have been indicted in the killing of Terrence and Ingrid and Lahey?
Well, the indictment announced charges against 6 people who were members of or worked with the FARC. And these are the people who not only carried out the operation at the time of the kidnapping and executions, but also the main leadership of FARC. The implication in indicting the main leadership, I think, as Attorney General Ashcroft put it, is it was an indictment of these 6 people and the FARC itself. The FARC is a what the U.S. calls a terrorist organization, and in the press conference, Ashcroft very swiftly was able to go from the indictment of these 6 specific people to an indictment of the organization, and used the indictment of the organization as a way to tacitly and almost explicitly endorse the 2003 budget proposal of heightened military aid to the Colombian government for fighting this counterinsurgency effort, basically. And that's not only in the 2003 appropriations request for pipeline protection in Colombia, but it's also in a supplemental budget request for 2002 of $6 million to jumpstart the effort of protecting the pipeline.
And in terms of what the role of the FARC has been in relationship to this, clearly the federal government here is attempting to be able to justify with an indictment the making the entire organization legal, even by U.S. standards. But what has been the FARC's role vis-a-vis the people who were involved in the murders?
The FARC's role vis-a-vis the
what's been involved. What was the FARC's response subsequent to the murders?
Well, immediately following the murders, I mean, immediately, FARC denied responsibility. Quickly, they realized they had done it, and they claimed responsibility. Then they claimed that the person and people who carried out the executions were just rogue local commanders who were not listening to the orders of the higher parts of the hierarchy in FARC. And that's what the indictments say otherwise. And let us be clear, we are not saying that we are feeling sympathetic to FARC. What we are objecting to is the twinning of the pursuit of justice for the murder of Terrence with the pursuit of the war on terror. That's what we're objecting to. We deplore the use of kidnapping and executions as political, economic, and military tools. And we demand that those responsible in this case be arrested, given a fair trial, and if proven guilty, sentenced severely with full respect for the due process of law in Colombia. That we're clear on that.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us, Abby Reyes, girlfriend of the late Terrence Freitas, who was killed along with Ingrid Washington-Wenatok and Lahe Gay in 1999. Six men have been indicted for that murder. And we also want to thank Julie Freitas, the mother of Terrence Freitas, for being with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, a quick look at some more information that's come out on the coup in Venezuela. Then we look at what abortion has to do with bankruptcy and finally roundtable discussion on 10 years after the L.A. uprising. Stay with us.
We got little kids with guns fighting inner city wars. So what do? We put these little kids behind prison doors. And he's standing up for what he believes in.
The Wasteland of the Free. Iris Dement here on Democracy Now!, breaking the sound barrier. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Yes, well, the story of Washington's involvement in a failed coup in Venezuela keeps changing. First, senior administration officials acknowledged that they met several times with coup leaders, were briefed of the situation in advance, didn't discourage people, and sent signals that Washington didn't like or doesn't like Chavez. The next day, it emerged that Otto Reich, a senior State Department official phoned Venezuelan coup leader Pedro Carmona the day he took office as interim president. Then the New York Times reported that the U.S. channeled hundreds of thousands of dollars in grants to American and Venezuelan groups opposed to President Hugo Chavez in the last year. And most recently, The Guardian of London reported the U.S. Navy aided the failed coup in Venezuela with intelligence from its vessels in the Caribbean. And we're joined by Duncan Campbell, the reporter for the London Guardian, who broke that story. Welcome to Democracy Now, Duncan.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you tell us what you have learned about the U.S. Navy and the attempted coup in Venezuela?
Yes. On the naval front, my information comes from Wayne Madsen, the former intelligence officer with the U.S. Navy, who now is an intelligence analyst, and you can see some of his stuff on intelligenceonline.com. And he said two interesting things. One, that from as long ago as last June, American military attaches had been down in Caracas liaising with the Venezuelan military. And this would obviously have been one of the aspects on which they were liaising. And the other, that the American Navy, which was down not for the reasons of the coup in the area, they're down for operations and training operations in the Caribbean anyway. But his information was that they had assisted in two ways. One, in signals intelligence, and his information, again, as I say, I'm quoting an intelligence analyst on it, was that they had assisted in the communications jamming between the diplomatic missions in Caracas that have been sympathetic to Chavez, because he has been sympathetic particularly to Cuba, but also he has also had dealings with Libya, Iraq, and Iran. And the other suggestion that Madsen made, which came from his sources, was that the U.S. Navy had been put on standby in the event that an evacuation of American citizens was necessary. There are something like, I think, 25,000 American citizens in Venezuela, some government officials and lots of people just who are in private business there. And so those were the two aspects. First of all, that there had been a lot of planning going back to as long ago as last June. And secondly, that once events started unraveling, that because of the proximity of the U.S. Navy, that they were asked for assistance. And the suggestion is that they gave it.
There have been reports in the Venezuelan press that there were U.S. Military in Fortiuna, the main military barracks in Caracas, during the coup. Did Madsen talk to you at all about that?
Yes, this is the same character referred to, somebody called James Rogers, the assistant military attaché in Caracas. And he was named by Roger Rondon, who's a congressman, a Venezuelan congressman, whose suggestion was that Rogers and another Officer Ronald McCammon, another an American there, had been seen at Fortuna at the time of the coup. Now, the American embassy in Caracas have said that suggestions that these people were in any way involved are ridiculous, and that, you know, there are good explanations as to why they were there on those particular occasions. In fact, the embassy spokesman said that there were no military personnel at the fort in the crucial periods, although two members of the defense attaché's office, one of them, Lieutenant Colonel Rogers, drove around the base on the afternoon of April the 11th.
And this is where Chavez was being held?
Yeah, this was where he was initially taken before he was taken to an island.
Presumably they were cruising for information around the fort. Right?
Well, that would be the suggestion. They said that Lieutenant Colonel Rogers drove around the base on the afternoon to check reports that it had been closed. Again, I mean, we're in a bit of a fog still, and I think it'll be a few weeks before exactly the exact sequence of events becomes clear.
And what did the Venezuelan congressman say about the U.S. ambassador to Venezuela, Shapiro?
Well, he said that Charles Shapiro, who's the American ambassador, who's a great Cuba hand, he's from the kind of Cuban desk in government activities, that he said we saw him leaving the Miraflores Palace, which is where the Chavez had been ousted from. Then they said we saw Mr. Shapiro leaving all smiles and embraces with the dictator, as he called him, Pedro Carmona, who was the person who was president for a day. His satisfaction was obvious. Shapiro's participation in the coup d'etat in Venezuela is evident. Again, this is very strenuously denied by the American embassy. But I was down in Caracas after the coup took place and met, in fact, Pedro Carmona, who was president for the day, who's under house arrest. And the original American government version of events was that, first of all, that Otto Reich had instructed Carmona that it was not acceptable for him to have dissolved the National Assembly, which is one of the things that he did when he was installed. He dissolved the National Assembly and the Supreme Court. And secondly, that version was changed after a day to say that Mr. Shapiro, the ambassador, had instructed him that he should not have dissolved the National Assembly. Now, Carmona, I asked Carmona specifically, were you given instructions by the American embassy that you should not dissolve the National Assembly? And he said no, he was not told one way or another. So there's this problem with one version coming from the American embassy as to what happened, and another from the person who was actually the president for the day.
Well, Duncan Campbell, I want to thank you very much for being with us, reporter for the London Guardian, as we continue to investigate what happened in the attempted coup in Venezuela, and particularly the U.S. role in that. London Guardian reporter Duncan Campbell's article is about the American Navy and how it may have helped the Venezuelan coup. And now we move to Washington, or stay in Washington, if that's what the coup is about, to talk about another story. A five-year struggle to rewrite U.S. bankruptcy laws is stalled in Congress this week over an amendment that would prevent anti-abortion protesters from wiping out their debts by filing bankruptcy. The financial industry has never been so close to tightening the rules on debtors. That's poor debtors as opposed to corporate debtors. Yet Republican leaders in the solidly anti-choice House of Representatives hint they may block the bill unless the language is changed. Despite intense pressure from the banking and credit card industries to save the legislation, the stridently anti-choice Congress member Henry Hyde has threatened to stop the bill. Countless anti-abortion protesters have used the bankruptcy laws to escape paying court-imposed fines or damages to abortion clinics in cities where violent protests have taken place. Pro-choice advocates say it's just one more legal loophole that's allowed anti-choice protesters to continue to wage war on clinics. Among those who have filed for bankruptcy is Randall Terry, founder and longtime leader of the anti-choice group Operation Rescue. We're joined in the studio by Martha Davis, who's vice president and legal director of the National Organization of Women Legal Defense and Education Fund, now Legal Defense and Education Fund. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks very much.
It's good to have you with us. Explain this whole story. Very odd that this huge corporate-backed bill is being stopped by pro-choice advocates, basically.
Well, let me just give you a little bit of background on the kinds of cases where these loopholes are used. As you mentioned, we've been going after Randall Terry for many years for mass protests that occurred in New York in the late 80s and early 90s. And these were not just exercises of First Amendment rights. These were massive blockades with hundreds, if not thousands, of arrests, people going inside of clinics, chaining themselves to property, damaging property, and so on. And as a result of that, we have a judgment against Randall Terry for about $300,000 for not only property damage, but fees that arose in the context of the attorney's fees that arose in the context of the lawsuit. And we were trying to get the, collect that judgment for about 10 years in the federal courts before Randall Terry in 1998 declared bankruptcy. We were just on the verge of being able to collect. We collected about $15,000 and also collected Randall Terry's frequent flyer miles in the process. But when he declared bankruptcy, the whole...
An incentive for him to stay home.
Exactly, right. That was our thought. But once he declared bankruptcy, then we were in a new venue. We were considered on a par with a number of his other creditors, credit card companies and so on. on. Now, we believe that the law, as it currently stands, would allow us to continue going after this debt, not only for Randall Terry, but also Joseph Foreman and other folks who have declared bankruptcy to try to avoid these judgments, because the law currently says that you cannot discharge through bankruptcy a debt that arises from intentional tortious activity. So just if you assaulted somebody and got damages for that, you couldn't then just declare bankruptcy to avoid paying that assault. That'd make it too easy for people to engage in that kind of activity. And we've had some success in the courts in Maryland against Joseph Foreman. The bankruptcy court said, you're right, this is a tortious, intentional tort, and he can't discharge this debt through the bankruptcy. But to go one by one in these cases and try to hope that the court is going to agree with us on that in order to make sure that we can continue to collect is very, very arduous process. We've already spent a lot of resources going after these folks. And so our hope would be that the Congress would be able to clarify this. Again, it doesn't have anything to do with stifling First Amendment activity, which would be able to continue. It's about making sure that people can't engage in intentional torts like trespass and assault and those kinds of damaging activities.
How did this provision get into the bankruptcy bill? Because it's been clearly the bill has been fought very hard by many consumer groups. And was Henry Hyde asleep at the time when the amendment was put into the bill, or what?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, Chuck Schumer from New York is the person who's been most advocating for this. A lot of these cases are in New York. That's where Randall Terry is. And it's also Chuck Schumer is the primary architect of the FACE law, the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act. And I think he probably sees this as an extension of that, because what's happened is that even with FACE and the success that that's had in cutting down these very violent protests, if folks can still avoid paying any fines at the end of the day, they may still go ahead and be violating people's rights.
So what is going to happen now? You have the Senate pass the bill that includes this. The House passed the bill on bankruptcy that doesn't include this. They're in conference committee now. Who's going to prevail?
Well, the thing
and
about
what
conference,
are you doing about it?
The
are
thing
you?
About conference is that it's behind closed doors, so it makes it hard to know who is going to prevail in the end. I mean, as I say, our hope is that that the law is clarified, but we're going to continue litigating one way or the other in the courts to try to continue to collect these fines.
Mm-hmm. And the people that you mentioned beyond Randall Terry, the specifics of these cases and why it is so important to you.
Sure. I mean, again, Joseph Foreman was involved as a ringleader in protests in Virginia, and I call them protests, but they were really violent, blockades of clinics. Also in the late 1980s, Jane Bray in Maryland was involved, also in this a case that involved property damage as well as
and
as
all have declared
fees.
Bankruptcy.
And all have declared bankruptcy. Clifford Gannett declared bankruptcy. A couple folks in upstate New York called the Beans, and then there's some people on the West Coast as well that we haven't personally been involved in, but Planned Parenthood and other groups have been going after.
Now, would this extend to other types of groups? For instance, I know that the Southern Poverty Law Center has gone legally after numerous hate groups as well and gotten judgments against them. Would this be specifically tailored to the groups that are involved in abortion issues, or would it be
in fact
widespread?
Hyde did say, didn't he, we don't feel that you should be able to single out a certain group of debtors in a bill.
Mm-hmm. Well, the law currently is that if you've committed an intentional tort, you can't discharge it through bankruptcy, so some of these folks would be under current law still liable for their debts. But in fact, the bill as originally written specifically talked about abortion clinics, and in response to concerns about that, it's now written more broadly and more generally, and bars discharging of bars discharging of debts for anybody who has barred entity that is giving goods and services to people from carrying out that activity. So it's no longer specific to abortion clinics. Again, though, the law also specifically says this would not affect people's First Amendment rights, and it's specifically spelled out in the law.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. We'll certainly follow this case right now. Again, it is in conference committee, and the Senate and the Congress are battling it out. Martha Davis, Vice President and Legal Director of the Now Legal Defense and Education Fund. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, a roundtable discussion on Los Angeles 10 years after the uprising.
Every rebel just a rebel in them story. Them a talk about the power and the glory. Them a talk about the burning and the looting. Them a talk about the smashing and the grabbing. Them a tell me about the vanquish and the victory. Them said the Babylon them went too far. So what we had was the bun to fear. And one and two innocent getting more. But what? No saw it for some time in a war. In star. No saw it for some time in a war. Them say we burn down the judge, we put up on the landlord. We burn down the judge, we never burn the landlord. When we run riot all over Brixton. When we mash up plenty police van. When we mash up the wicked one plan. When we mash up the swamp 81. Them say we commandeer care and we gather ammunition. We build we barricade and the wicked catch afraid. We send out we scout, we go find them we're about. Then we farm up, we posse and we make we raid. Now them run gang up and counter action. But the plastic bullet and the water cannon will bring a blam.
Linton Kwesi Johnson, The Great Insurrection. Here on Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. This week marks the 10th anniversary of one of the largest uprisings in modern U.S. history in Los Angeles, sparked by the acquittal of four white police officers who were videotaped beating an African-American man, Rodney King. On April 29, 1992, an all-white jury acquitted the four white officers in the beating, this despite an explicit videotape of the officers violently hitting, batoning, kicking King as he lay on the ground. After the videotape was broadcast, a grand jury indicted all four officers on a number of charges. But after the judge moved the trial to the largely white enclave of Simi Valley, the jury acquitted the officers of all charges. An hour and 15 minutes later, people took to the streets in rage and the L.A. rebellion began. The furious reaction spread to cities around the country. 10 years ago in L.A., 55 people were killed, more than 2,300 injured, more than 1,100 buildings damaged or destroyed, over 13,000 National Guard and federal officers called in by President Bush Sr. He blamed the so-called L.A. riots on the social welfare programs of the 1960s and 70s. But community leaders in L.A. say it was not the acquittal of the white officers alone that sparked the violence. It was a spontaneous combustion fueled by institutionalized racism in the city and the LAPD, escalating unemployment and deep poverty. Most of the 10,000 people arrested during the uprising were Latino and Black young men. Today on Democracy Now!, we're going to look at how Los Angeles has changed in the decades since the uprising. We are joined by several people. Michael Zinzin, former member of the Black Panther Party, chair of the Coalition Against Police Abuse. Charles Kim, head of the Korean American Coalition, a Los Angeles Black Korean Alliance. And Samuel Paz, national vice president for the ACLU in Los Angeles, has been a civil rights attorney in L.A. for some 30 years and worked on the Rodney King and the Rampart scandal. Juan.
Yes, well, I'd like to begin with Michael Zinzin, former member of the Black Panther Party and chair of the Coalition Against Police Abuse. How has Los Angeles changed and how have relationships between the African-American community, the larger city changed in the 10 years since the Rodney King assault and the rebellion?
Well, I think that if we have to do a report card on the city of L.A., I think they got a D. And they got a D because city officials and the wealthy of L.A. are so preoccupied with themselves that there's been no long-range changes. And I believe as a result of that, we find that the LAPD hasn't changed that much. We find out that the city, like I said, is spending so much time elsewhere that the ones they can blame are the youth. So now we have another situation where you have the criminalization of so many young people. And I think that this is one of our main concerns right now. The police have not changed. And that's what our concern is.
Michael Zinzin, you yourself were beat up by police, right? And they were forced to settle.
I lost an eye. And, yeah, they were forced to settle. But that still doesn't have anything with our main demand, which is community control of the police, community control of our communities. And I think that a lot of these things were just addressed when we had the 35th anniversary of the Black Panther Party in D.C., you see. Well, we sent a contingent out to the support the Palestinians. I think all these things on a local, national, international level are all together.
I'd like to ask Charles Kim, who's joining us also from the Korean American Coalition. I was in Los Angeles during the uprising and covered all of the days of the violence, as well then subsequently as the second federal trial of the police officers. And one of the things that, especially in the black community, I heard expressed very often, because as you are well aware, the Korean community was targeted. Many Korean businesses were targeted for attack. Was the rage over the case of Latasha Harlins, the 15-year-old African-American teenager who had been killed by a Korean store owner who then subsequently was convicted but not given any jail time, basically sentenced to probation. And that had occurred just a few months, the trial, before the Rodney King decision. And it was felt that this was two instances of outright racist verdicts in Los Angeles. How have relationships developed since then between the Korean community and the African American and Latino community, or and the Asian community, which is very large in Los Angeles?
Yes, 10 years ago, the Korean community was severely damaged. With 3,300 buildings were looted and burned and damaged, and we lost about $400 million worth of businesses and inventories and all that. But you mentioned about the Sun Jae-do case, but what we know as a person on the street and what courts knows, all the evidences, there are big differences. We don't have all the evidences, but court has the evidences, and judge made a decision to acquit her and put a, not acquit her, but put her 2 years probation and a $500 fine. And if I was a member of black community, probably I'll be also outraged because there was a killing, but this person is not in jail. But however, that was the court decision. So I think that triggered, together with what happened to Rodney King, the riots. But there are many Korean-owned stores were targeted specifically by some of the gang members or whoever caused the riots. But many Korean stores are just bystanders. We have many retail stores in South Central Los Angeles in L.A., and we became the victim. And since then, last 10 years, of course, there's increased awareness between those two communities. And then we have worked very diligently to develop working relationship with black community and our Latino community. I have to say that we have better relationship, definitely better relationship than 10 years ago. However, what I have also found was the kind of disappointment for the so-called community leaders and political leaders and fortifying. What I see that the city of Los Angeles is islands of Los Angeles. We don't have bridges. Even the bridges that we had, leaders burned the bridges, fortified their islands, and then declared their kingdom. So I have seen the more isolation among different communities and groups. And I don't see the serious effort to build the bridges. That's the problem that I see now.
What did you think of President Bush coming to Los Angeles on the anniversary of the uprising? You were there at the roundtable.
I was with President Bush. It was very friendly and very sincere discussion that we had, President, for about 45 minutes. And I think it's a big gesture on President Bush's part to visit South Los Angeles, South Central Los Angeles on the...
Yeah, I think we may have lost Mr. Kim, but we're also joined by Samuel Paz, the National Vice President for the ACLU in Los Angeles. And welcome to Democracy Now, Samuel.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine. I would like to ask you, given the fact that most people see what happened in Los Angeles as an uprising based largely on the Rodney King decision and racial conflict within that Los Angeles, but most people are not aware that the largest group of people arrested of the thousands that were arrested after in the days of the rebellion were Latino. And what's been the development since then for the Latino community in relationship to the police, as well as to the other ethnic and racial groups within Los Angeles?
Well, as maybe many of your listeners know, the demographics in Los Angeles have constantly been changing, and so the area that was traditionally the area of the black community, which was, of course, the the center of the Watts riots in 1965, has changed to be predominantly now Latino in most parts. The history of LAPD in the Latino and Black community in Los Angeles has always been a very sordid story. The Watts riots were sparked after approximately 60 people, mostly Blacks, had been killed by the LAPD. 25 of those were unarmed people. The spark there, again, was an arrest and abuse of a Black family by LAPD. The same thing occurred in 1970 with the LAPD and the sheriffs attacking 25,000 anti-war, mostly Chicanos in East L.A., Ruben Salazar, an L.A. Times reporter, was killed. The most recent scandal, the Rampart scandal, of course, was predominantly Latinos who were arrested and set up by the LAPD, sent to prison, and over 100 cases have been overturned, and thousands have been investigated. But it's just a sordid experience that we've had with our police department, a police department that simply, as Michael Zinsen said earlier, simply refuses to be part of the community and simply has always acted on its own.
I would like to add that new thing happening. Racial profiling still exists. Now, Sam...
You're saying racial profiling still exists?
Huh?
You're saying racial profiling still exists?
Yes, racial... I want to say hi to Sam, too.
How you doing, my guy?
We both have gone... for a number of years addressing the question of racism within the police department and the impact it's had on both the Black and Chicano communities. And I think it's we have to look at a series of things. Some people say, well, they changed policies. I'm talking about unwritten policies. I'm talking about a method for approaching the Black and Chicano community that has resulted in people not only going to jail, but police officers saying, well, I must not be doing something. I ain't doing nothing wrong, so because I'm not going to jail myself. So they continue to set up these customs and practices. And is a result of even Gates had enough nerve to tell me he's going to run for police chief out here. You know what I'm saying? Are we going back in time? What's happening?
Michael Zinsen, what was your reaction to some of the issues raised by Charles Kim? He said that there had been attempts, for instance, in the Korean American community, which suffered greatly during the because of attacks during the rebellion, in terms of repairing or improving relationships between the African American and the Korean community, or between the Korean community and Chicano community.
That our Korean brothers and sisters sure treat us a lot better now. You know what I'm saying? And I think that I don't think he was there at times when Koreans who were or Asians who were fair to our community, we surrounded their places to protect them. You see, those are the kinds of stories that aren't told. You see, but if you're going to treat me like a dog, I'm going to act like one. But I'm saying there were people that actually we went out. You know what I'm saying? And so that's what I'm saying. You know, I'm not no businessman. And I see a problem with Bush coming to L.A., you know, acting like he's so concerned about what's wrong with our communities. Because the racism that he's promoting, I think, only creates a justification or attempt to justify what the police are doing in the city of L.A., even to this day.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all for being with us, Michael Zinsen, with the Coalition Against Police Abuse. Charles Kim, head of the Korean American Coalition, and Samuel Paz, National Vice President of the ACLU in Los Angeles. That does it for the show. Go to our website at www.democracynow.org for all contacts and more information about this program. You can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. We're broadcasting from a Firehouse Studio at Downtown Community Television, blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening.
Another Holocaust. Oh, everybody better wake up. Everybody better wake up. The superpowers better wake up. The world powers better wake up.